At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive.
All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Melody Hartzler, founder and owner of Farm to Table. Today, we are going to talk about a really special topic that is very close to many of us, and that is mental health. And depression and anxiety specifically is what we're going to focus on today on the podcast. And the reason we're talking about this is because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's really a perfect time to discuss the mental health problems. I mean, many of us have seen how exacerbated, I guess, in a way, this problem has become since the pandemic because of so much isolation. I've been seeing it a lot in family medicine practice and children that are coming to the family medicine practice. So we wanted to talk about that today, but also bring in this functional and lifestyle medicine approach to mental illness, because there's just so much that we could talk about related to the gut and the hormones in the gut and the brain. Lauren said it already before we got started, though. You could probably talk for 2 hours about this topic. But it's so important to us, and we do want to just start off the bat by saying the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, you are thinking about suicide or worried about a friend or a loved one or need emotional support, we want to make sure we put that number for you up front. So that's 1-800-273-TALK. Again, that's 1-800-273-TALK, which is 8255. But this hotline is a great number to share with any friends that you know that are in crisis or struggling with anxiety, depression, to make sure that they have it written down, but they have trained crisis workers available to talk 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and confidential. So we just wanted to put that out there before we got talking about all the other things that we believe can be really helpful for patients that are going through these conditions. So I have with me today around the table, Lauren Castle, who is the founder of FMPHA, which is a Functional Medicine Pharmacist Alliance. And she is a pharmacist, a community pharmacist background. And Lauren is here in Ohio. And then also we have Dr. Megan Morrison as well, who is in Texas. So she woke up early to record with us today. So we'll go ahead and get started. Lauren, do you want to kick us off and just sort of talk about mental health and how the pandemic has maybe influenced this?
Sure, absolutely. So mental health obviously has become a very hot topic. And previously, I don't even think we really used the word mental health. We used the word mental illness. And so it just goes to show how much the stigma is really starting to change around this topic. So how do we define mental health? We really think about it as a state of well-being where an individual really realizes their own abilities and they can cope with the normal stresses of life. They can work productively and really be a contributing member of their community. And for anyone who's gone through mental health struggles, you can understand how in each of those things, they become tainted in a way where you don't recognize your own abilities. You can't cope with normal stresses of life. You can't work productively. And you're certainly not feeling like you can contribute to your community. So the pandemic, like Melody said, has really made this problem so much worse. So in 2019, prior to the pandemic, there were about 19% of adults that experienced a mental illness. So about 50 million Americans. And now after the pandemic, the CDC reports that 41% of adults have exhibited Wow. symptoms of anxiety or depression. So it's literally doubled that prevalence. And so again, that's why we're talking about it today, because we have an entire month dedicated to the awareness around it, but sometimes awareness is not enough. There's so much action that needs to be taken. And so that's what we really want to make sure you can get out of this episode today.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, not great that that happens, but a good lead in to what we're going to talk about today. But yeah, I think the isolation piece and like the fact that we, and we've talked about this before, probably on the podcast and other things that we have done, but just like the body is designed to be in community. Our bodies, you know, our souls are supposed to be in community with one another. And so when we are so isolated, that I think that just
raises a lot of these numbers and is one of the causes, and certainly the uncertainties and things going into that too. But awesome. Well, Megan, why don't you take us through sort of what the standard of care approach is to mental health? And we're not necessarily saying at any point in this podcast that folks should not do the standard of care, because they absolutely can be life-saving medications. We are just talking about, you know, what the standard of care is and other things that we can do to complement that is our purpose today.
Exactly. Thanks for saying that, Melody. We are a group of pharmacists, so we do want to talk about medications because that really is our standard of care in conventional medicine, medications and therapy. Hopefully those two combined, but sometimes for different reasons, we may only have access to one or the other. But for depression and anxiety, there is some overlap in the medications that are used. You may have heard of SSRIs. It's kind of a big one, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, things like Lexapro and Zoloft and Paxil. Those are pretty common. There's also SNRIs and some other different kinds of medications, tricyclic antidepressants. Those are a little bit older, Wellbutrin. And like I said, some of those overlap with anxiety. There's also benzodiazepines. That's a big one for anxiety. And these medications can be great. They can work great for some people and are definitely an option, but there are, you know, adverse effects that we can see from these medications. A big one is GI distress and insomnia. They can cause sexual dysfunction and even weight gain, which, you know, maybe with some of the older ones, but that can definitely be an issue for some people. And one thing about these medications is some of them can be very hard to come off of. And if for whatever reason, if, you know, you are maybe in the future or now like needing to come off of one of these medications, it can be very hard. And it's kind of hard to predict. Like some people do totally fine coming off of these medications and some people really suffer. So it's just something to keep in mind, you know, before we, not that we're necessarily throwing these medications at patients, but, you know, think about these sort of things before starting. And Melody said, we're going to talk about the functional medicine approach. Like there are a lot of things that we can do maybe before starting a medication to really get the body in balance and get the mind and body connection strong before starting these medications. And then Lauren, I think, was going to talk about like the therapy part of it. So Lauren, take that away.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing to add with medications as well is something called pharmacogenomics is an area that pharmacists are becoming more involved with. And it's particularly helpful in mental health because we know that a lot of patients, there's not really a great way to figure out which patient will respond to which drug. And so that's why sometimes we see that patients will try multiple different antidepressants before they finally find something that helps them. And so now with pharmacogenomics, you can actually test to find out if you're even going to respond to certain drugs or if you're not going to be having as good of a response to it. So if that's something that you've been struggling with, or you're one of those patients that's had to try multiple drugs and still aren't feeling your best, then that can be a really helpful option. We've got some pharmacists on our team that actually can help with that too.
Along with that, real quick, nutrigenomics is also a thing in this space because patients that have, there's been connections between genetic variants of MTHFR, which is a enzyme in the body that actually helps convert your folic acid into your folate into activated folate. But they've definitely seen that patients with major depressive disorder have these variants, and then they also have lower blood levels of these activated folate. Definitely something to consider, like could genetics be playing a role in something? And the correlation between folate status and depression symptoms is still something that's being researched, you know, further. So it's just another reason to know your genes, whether you're looking at it through the lens of what prescription medication is going to be the most effective and how do I choose that for myself versus, you know, nutrient wise and things that we might need to do there.
Yep, absolutely. So getting into some of the therapy, there's lots of different options with this. We traditionally think about talk therapy as sort of you know, you lay back on the couch and your psychiatrist or your counselor will ask you, you know, tell me about your childhood, tell me about your mother. That's what we call psychodynamic therapy. It's kind of the original Freudian style where basically we understand that things that have happened to us through our childhood and the experiences that we go through can shape both our conscious thoughts and our unconscious thoughts as well. And so there's a lot that you might have to kind of work through or unpack to understand why you are the way that you are in the world today. But some of the newer therapies that have kind of replaced that older model are things like CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. This basically says that the reason we behave a certain way or we feel a certain way all stems from our thoughts. And it can be very challenging when you're going through anxiety and depression. And, you know, personal story is last year, I actually went through this myself. My mom had passed away. I was struggling at work and finally just got to a point where I had to take that leave of absence and seek help. And it was the best decision that I could have made to actually go into an intensive outpatient therapy and go 3 days a week, because for some people, we wait until things get that bad when really we probably should have been going to therapy for a decade before that. So therapy is definitely becoming much more common, much more popular, and much more accessible, thanks to a lot of different, you know, applications and online programs. And of course, with the pandemic making telehealth an option for so many, there's really a lot more capabilities for people to get into therapy. So going back to the different types, cognitive behavioral therapy, you're basically trying to pinpoint what those thoughts are that are creating those feelings of depression or anxiety. So you might be, you know, feeling sad and having trouble getting out of bed. And you have to really dig deep and try to identify what thought is triggering that feeling. And it can be, like I said, very challenging. And a lot of times this works really well if you combine it with things like meditation, especially if you have a lot of anxiety and your thoughts are racing. It feels impossible to try and slow your thoughts down enough to even realize what you're thinking. So combining it with things like meditation helps you become more aware of those thoughts. Another type of therapy is called dialectical behavioral therapy. This is really originally came for people that had borderline personality disorder, but it's really been expanded and used for a lot of different types of therapy. And it's essentially about finding the gray area or seeing both sides and finding balance in things. It's very easy to have an all or nothing mentality whenever you are experiencing depression or anxiety. And I know for me, I felt this way a lot of times. I literally thought I was going to be fired from my job. Like that was a reoccurring thought that I could not get out of my head. And so I realized that, you know, through using these types of therapies, like, okay, well, that's the worst case scenario, but what's the flip side of this? Well, the flip side is that absolutely nothing could happen. And they're not even going to have a problem with something that I did or said. And so you learn to be able to see both sides of the coin instead of just focusing on only the negative. And then the third is called acceptance and commitment therapy. This is ACT, a little bit less common than CBT and DBT, but I personally found this one really helpful because there were some times where, you know, especially going through something like grief, where you really had a hard time trying to find your thoughts and try to change your thoughts into something more positive. That's another aspect of CBT that some people struggle with, is that it's all about, well, you can control your feelings because you can change your thoughts. And it's like, well, sometimes I'm just going to be sad and there is not going to be a happy way to turn this around. And so that's where ACT comes in. It's basically about just accepting that some things do happen that we can't control, but what we can control is more of our response. And so you really evaluate your values and the things that are important to you. And then you try and basically compare the situation and what's happening to what your values are. And that's where you can decide how you want to respond. So it might still be a really sad or frustrating or difficult situation.
And your thoughts aren't necessarily going to be able to change the situation, but you can rely on your values and what's important to you and change things that you can change to create a different situation. So I find that really helpful. It's also used for people that experience panic attacks as well, because sometimes with panic attacks, you're, you know, also really not going to be in a position to try and change your thoughts very quickly, but you can simply accept and kind of slow down and just recognize, like, what is happening to me? What am I feeling? Okay, I feel my heart racing. That's okay. My heart's racing. I can deal with it. I can breathe. I can change, you know, how I'm going to respond to this, and you can get through it. So those are kind of the three major therapies. And like I said, nowadays it's much more easy to find someone that can offer therapy, whether you go into a type of program that's more intensive or you just go online and try it once or twice a week. It can be really, really helpful. So other types of therapies that are also becoming more popular are things like mindfulness meditations. We kind of talked about meditation. Also, even just relaxation therapy, where you can turn on some relaxing music, kind of close your eyes, or do visualizations. And then lastly, something called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR. And this is definitely a newer therapy, but it's very, very helpful, especially for trauma. And basically, it's stimulating both sides of your brain through different sensations. So sometimes they'll use certain beats or music where you're hearing it through headphones on both sides. Other times they'll use something that actually stimulates both sides of your eyes. So they might have special glasses that you can wear that show different color patterns, but it all is all about getting both sides of your brain to basically kind of communicate and reestablish some connections that may have been sort of affected through different traumas. So that's another therapy that's been very helpful.
Awesome. That's a great description of that. The one I would add for trauma specifically, there's a program called DNRS, Dynamic Neuronal Retraining System. And basically it is a self-directed program that people can go through online specifically for people with trauma and anxiety, but it's really focused on neuroplasticity, which is a term that means basically the brain's ability to adapt and change. And so this ability to change can be in both positive and negative ways. And so being that the brain is the control center for optimal health and drives the functioning in the body, the limbic system specifically is the set of the midbrain that's associated with emotions and learning and memory and the body's stress response. So when we have this ongoing stress through various forms of trauma, which could be emotional, could be physical infections, could be psychological stress, toxic exposure, injuries, the body's brain limbic system is firing more rapidly, so that even when the boss says, hey, I want to talk to you, all of a sudden you're having this rapid response because maybe it's trauma based on a past conversation, or maybe it's based on your body's just wired to be really nervous about that because of all of these insults that it's had. So this program is really about retraining that innate response to stress and trauma and not getting stuck in that fight or flight. And so it can be a really great tool for patients, especially like I mentioned, for past trauma. So combining that with traditional therapy or EMDR could be a really great option for people that are working on that. Because we talk about that a lot, the stress overdrive, and really that maladaptation to the limbic system is really what drives a lot of anxiety and panic attacks, like Lauren was mentioning.
Buddy, so I just wanted to second that.
Oh yes, because you have done that program.
Yeah, I've actually done that program and honestly think no matter what you're going through, everyone could benefit from DNRS. And, you know, this isn't sponsored at all, but yeah, I did it. And it can be intense. Any kind of therapy, like Lauren said, can be intense, but it's so rewarding. And I've saw so many changes with it. A lot of people go to DNRS for a chronic condition, Lyme, just different chemical sensitivities, all sorts of things. But the mental piece, I think, is like, it's not talked about enough. And it's huge. It really is huge. So I definitely recommend it. You can do it at home on your own time, or they actually have classes. And now that the pandemic, things have kind of gotten a little bit back to normal, I think they have those too, these like intense 4 days or whatever. Yeah. So definitely check it out. We can put that in the show notes too.
Perfect.
Awesome. So really what it comes down to is that we believe as practitioners of functional medicine that we really are just seeing patients that the standard of care is there. It is doing good things for a lot of people. But even in the meta-analysis recently, they've talked about like combined psychotherapy, which is this, all the things that Lauren talked about, and pharmacotherapy, only 46% of patients are actually reaching remission. So we're still missing half of the people, over half of the people that are still struggling with anxiety and depression, despite our standard of care options. And treatment adherence is another thing we talk about a lot as pharmacists. So we know that it's hard to take medications every day or get things in your schedule or make the time to go to those cognitive behavioral sessions or those other appointments that you may have from a therapy perspective. So there's a huge percentage of adults that still are struggling and still have needs. And so that's really what's, you know, the shift. We need to have this shift, a paradigm shift in our approach to mental care. It needs to be not only the counseling and not only the medications, but also adding this whole body functional medicine approach to really look deeper to see like what are the stresses going on in the body that are causing some of those traumas. So some of the things that we talk about a lot, and we mentioned with this DNRS system that some of these patients might have an infection. So sometimes immune dysregulation can actually come from a chronic infection. Whether that be Lyme disease can present as chronic infections, strep, which is a common bacteria that many of us are exposed into childhood, sometimes can cause an autoimmune reaction, more commonly known as PANDAS or PANDAS, which is an abbreviation. A lot of kids, there's a very strict criteria for diagnosing PANDAS, but there's probably a lot of a spectrum that this could be on, that your body still could have this immune reaction. And the criteria for diagnosing PANDAS is related to clinical trials. And this is what we need to call it, because we need to look at when you're looking at something that's more subjective in order to show improvements and things in the clinical trials. But there's definitely somewhat of a spectrum of that. And then viral infections, we've got patients with chronic EBV infections, CMV infections, other things that contribute to this inflammation, and certainly other bacteria and yeast infections can also be somewhat chronic, especially when we talk about the gut, which we talk about a lot around here. And then we also need to look at dietary things. So much of the standard American diet is depleted in things like magnesium, which is super important for calming. We know that we use magnesium therapeutically to help people have a little bit of calming effect in the evening sometimes, or even during the day, depending on what types of magnesium we're using. We also know that the standard American diet is very depleted in omega-3 fatty acids, and omega-3 fatty acids are so important for brain function. So when we don't have those and we have this inflammation generated from those types of foods, so those oils that are being used in the frying of things a lot of times and depleted of nutrients, we get inflammation, and that can really contribute to some of this physical symptom of mental health, physical symptoms that we see. And so omega-3s are, I don't think I've ever tested a person. I've been doing functional medicine testing now for probably 6 years. And I don't think any time I've ever tested someone's nutrients that their omega-3 to omega-6 ratio was in range without them being on some kind of supplementation. So that just tells you. And really, if you think about what foods omega-3 fatty acids are in, we're talking fish and we're talking flaxseed and some of these very specific things that the majority of Americans are not consuming on a regular basis. And we're also not able to consume as much fish as we wanted to in previous decades because of the mercury issues. And so there's just a lot of balance that has to happen there. But blood sugar dysregulation, do one of you guys want to speak on that? I know, Megan, you might want to share your experience with talking to people about that.
Sure. So just blood sugar spikes, you know, our blood sugar kind of going up and down throughout the day. Maybe we're one of those individuals, and I've been guilty of this in the past. You wake up, you don't have time, you're running out the door to work, and you have a cup of coffee, and then you grab a donut at work, and then your blood sugar spikes, and then you crash. And so you're on this roller coaster all day long, up and down, and that can impact us in so many different ways. But balancing our blood sugar, making sure that we're eating a good amount of healthy fats and protein and complex carbohydrates, just so we're not getting those spikes and our mood isn't going up and down. You've seen like those Snickers commercials, like you're not yourself when you're hungry. Maybe in the afternoon, a lot of us you know, probably been there, like you crash and you want to reach for that sugar because your blood sugar's low, and regulating your blood sugar is super important. Like I said, for a lot of different things, but for mood, certainly.
Yeah. And cortisol, you know, increases when that blood sugar is dysregulated. I have a couple of patients recently that will describe to me like, oh, I just feel like I have to eat like right now, like a little bit shaky, or they might wake up in the middle of the night to feed a child and they're shaky. And that can be a sign that there's low blood sugar going on and that there's some dysregulation. So we could do a whole podcast on fixing those things and how, you know, nutritionally we work with patients on that. So we'll save that for another day. But other things that we have to think about is our sedentary lifestyle in America. So we've got to get moving, because endorphins are created, dopamine is created when we exercise, and it's a really important part of addressing mental health and the mental, you know, health pandemic per se. So getting active, also, you know, if someone is isolated, getting active within like a community of people, getting active, having that walking partner, joining that group of people, going to an exercise class. So we get endorphins not only from the exercise, but also the community piece. So super important. And then there's also something called impaired neurogenesis. So basically the neurons in your brain can be inhibited by these high levels of cortisol from chronic stress. So we talked about all these things that can cause chronic stress, the infections, the diet, the lifestyle, blood sugar dysregulations. So we can get low levels of other neurotransmitters, and we can also get chronic inflammation. And this can change our microbiome just from this stress and this brain piece. So there's a term we use a lot called the gut-brain axis. We know that even stressful events with, you know, someone goes to the ICU, they get no antibiotics, they just had this stressful event, their gut microbiome changes. And there's other literature talking about other things that have, you know, similar effects on that. So we have to consider stress as a big trigger and why some people may experience gut symptoms and turn into, you know, some of our patients that present with their bloating and constipation and diarrhea and all of those things. It can be related to stress. And then there's also a whole nother, there's traumatic brain injury patients that this, you know, may be a result of that. And working with a provider, that Dr. Andrew Heyman is one that comes to mind. He works with a lot of traumatic brain injury patients in the functional and integrative space, but you definitely need someone that is very focused on that and that knows what they're doing there. We can get some faulty gut brain axis signaling when we have this stress process going. So we also work on that with our patients. But some other things, blue light therapy can be helpful, circadian rhythm disruption and this whole stress, you know, you should wake up and your cortisol should be the highest that it is in the day. And then 30 minutes later, it is going to be even higher. And then throughout the day, it's going to sort of level off so that it's lower at night when your melatonin starts to rise. But some people get disruption in that process. They might wake up and their cortisol is through the roof as soon as they wake up, or it's through the roof at night before they're supposed to be going to bed and they feel their mind is just racing when they're laying down. I talk to a lot of patients in family medicine that are struggling with pain, that are struggling with different chronic illnesses, and insomnia is huge. And just the healthcare system right now just doesn't have those conversations with patients about that cortisol piece, the stress response, how that's affecting their sleep, and you know, all of those things. So definitely looking into some of those blue light things, and even just lamps on your desk to wake you up in the morning can help get that proper cortisol rise if fatigue is something that you struggle with. So anything else you guys want to say about those sections?
I'll just mention one thing real quick. You talking about sleep, Melody, yeah. And circadian rhythm, even just getting outside first thing in the morning, yes. If you can, like step outside for 5 minutes, work that into your schedule somehow, but your eyes seeing that light, even if it's not sunny where you are, but that has a huge impact on your circadian rhythm. So, I mean, it's free.
Yeah. And I think that's why so many people have struggled. I struggle in the winter to get out of bed because it's dark outside. It's like, oh my goodness, but your body, it's really just how our body works. We're supposed to have this rhythm of when it's light, we get up, and when it's dark, you know, we don't.
Yeah. And you think about it, you know, we're indoors. So many of us are indoors all day long and then all night, and we're not waking up with the sunlight or the natural light. And then at night we have all these artificial lights around us that are keeping us up, when really, when the sun goes down and it starts to get dark outside, that's when we should be too. We should be in that dark environment, and many of us are not. And I'm definitely guilty of being on my phone or watching TV at night, but it really impacts our circadian rhythm, and that impacts all, you know, our overall health and definitely our mood and mental health.
Yeah. So I think I misspoke when I said blue light therapy. I meant blue light is cause of our circadian disruption. I was thinking in my head, red light therapy is another potential option, but so many colors of light, right? But right. Blue light is what interrupts our circadian rhythms. And so you can actually get blue light blocking glasses, which can be helpful for patients that do maybe have to be on a computer at night. Maybe you work or in the evening and coming home, you're wanting to wind down. And so those kinds of things can be helpful for patients, but there are light boxes. So there are light boxes that you can use to have, if it is dark outside and you do need that waking up, you can have a light box on your desk and other types of red light therapy that have been shown to be helpful in this space. But blue light is what we want to block. And then, so we talked a little bit about genetic variants and mental illness. There are some other genetic variants besides MTHFR that could be playing a role. So we talked about that one, but there's COMT, which is the variant I actually have this, but it causes, and there's different ones of this, like MTHFR, there's a million different subtypes, and same thing with COMT, but the COMT is where your neurotransmitters don't get broken down as quickly. And so that can sometimes cause anxiety and OCD like behaviors. So if that's something you struggle with, there can be, you know, and certain supplements may be good for that. Certain supplements may be bad for that. So working with providers that understand the genetic piece or the underlying genetic piece and knowing your genetics can be helpful in those conditions. Other things that we haven't talked about that can be triggers from a functional perspective can be those environmental things. So we can have things like mold infections. We can have electromagnetic fields that are, you know, causing issues. Heavy metal toxicity is another thing. I was recently at the A4M Spring Congress. Lauren was there too. But in my section, the module that I was completing, they talked a lot about heavy metals and how that can help play a role in neurological conditions. So whether it's these mental health conditions or if it's Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, sometimes these heavy metals can affect how the brain is functioning. And sometimes it's someone's eating fish every day and they're getting too much mercury. Sometimes it's a water supply issue. We've talked a lot about detoxification in our space and talking about cleaning your water and making sure the water's clean. I've got one patient that had copper pipes in her house and her copper level was high. And so even some of those things that we're supposed to have in our body can be at too high of levels and affecting some of our health in, you know, a more general sense. So when we talk about functional medicine, Lauren, do you want to talk about sort of the functional medicine process and how this is different than how with the sort of diagram that we have there?
Yeah. So one thing that we like to say in functional medicine that's a little different than how we think about it in traditional medicine, right? Because traditionally in conventional medicine, we'll say that depression and anxiety are basically just imbalances in your brain. Like your neurotransmitters are just out of whack. That's why you're depressed. That's why you're anxious.
That's the only answer we've got for you.
Right. But clearly, based on the conversation we've had thus far, we can see how one condition like depression could have many different causes. So it could be from omega-3 deficiencies. It could be from antibiotic use that's disrupted your gut. It could be from something like prediabetes, where your blood sugar levels are too high. It could be from vitamin D deficiency, which we talked about, not getting enough sunlight and that causing depression. Or it could be something like low thyroid hormones, which can also cause depression. So it could be one condition that has all kinds of different causes, and someone might have one of these and someone else could have a different cause, or one person could have all of these things, creating a really severe case. But then on the flip side of that, we also think about how for many people, they might have a lot of comorbid conditions. So maybe they have depression, but then they also have things like heart disease or diabetes or arthritis and all these other conditions. And yet they all have something in common. And for most people, that's something like inflammation, right? Where you have this biochemical process happening throughout your body due to all of these other causes. But when we look at the functional medicine lens, we're trying to get to the true root cause and look at that through that biochemical lens. So that will help us inform how we want to proceed with a treatment strategy and prioritize what areas we want to focus on. So I think next we'll get into some of the different treatment areas specifically that we wanted to highlight. Specifically, gut health is next.
Yes, the microbiome is this gut-brain axis piece. So in one direction, we have the central nervous system sending signals to the gut, which help to what we used to call modulate the microbiome, what bugs are there, how they function, and the brain controls motility. So when we talk about that signal of, you know, we need to have a bowel movement and help the gut sort of move along, that part is controlled centrally. And then we also have the gastric acid secretion being controlled by the brain. And all of those, the motility and the gastric acid also play a role in regulating the microbiome and what bugs are there. And if the acid is too low, we have potential for acid too low or pH too high, then we have the potential for overgrowth of certain microbes. So the brain is involved there, but in the other direction, the microbiota or the microbiome either interface with components of the peripheral nervous system, and then they relay signals to the brain and the central nervous system. So much serotonin is actually made in the gut, which is really important. I can't remember the exact percentage, but it's a good chunk of our serotonin. And then engaging in other tryptophan metabolism, we're even able to make neurotransmitters such as GABA, which is a really calming, relaxing neurotransmitter, histamine, norepinephrine, dopamine, all of those neurotransmitters that we talk about, and even drug receptor, we're working at, they have drugs, then that's the whole SSRI. We get more serotonin or more serotonin and norepinephrine. Those are the targets, and those things are actually made in the gut metabolism, and so much of that is involved with the microbiome. So certain patients can become histamine intolerant. Sometimes that is related to a bacteria or a strain in the gut that is actually making too much histamine or contributing to too much histamine. So certain strains of bacteria create each of these types of neurotransmitters. So it's really important when we're considering all the impacts of the microbiome that we also consider that the mucosal immune system is also involved in this inflammation and immune system piece. And so the endocrine system is actually connected here too. So we also have hormones that are involved. We call it the HPA axis, which we've mentioned before on the podcast, which is that stress response. And it's the brain sending the signals to the adrenal glands and the adrenal glands making hormones. And then we, you know, get this feedback of all the different processes. So we have the four systems really happening. We have the neurons happening, we have immune system, we have the endocrine system, and we have the microbiome system. And they're all sort of, sometimes we refer it to in functional medicine like it's an orchestra or a symphony, because everybody's playing the different parts and the role to make this beautiful song that's happening. And so that's the best way to sort of describe it in simple terms. But we have all of these different pieces of the puzzle that are needing to be put together. And a lot of that does happen with influence of the microbiome. They talked a lot in a conference that we just went to about the connection between microbiome diversity and chronic disease. Like, it's one of the most well-known things now. Like, if your microbiome is not diverse, there are very specific chronic diseases that can result of that, and mood disorders and things like this can be part of that. So Lauren, why don't you talk a little bit about the nutrition component and how the diet modulates all of these different things?
Absolutely. So diet modulates a lot of different key biological processes that underscore mood disorders. So things like brain plasticity and function, the stress response system, mitochondria, inflammation, oxidative processes, and a Western dietary pattern is associated with increased inflammation. We've pretty much covered that. So the treatment really is quite simple, not necessarily easy, but simple. And that is a whole food diet, one that's going to provide adequate protein and those essential fatty acids, as well as all of the micronutrients that are so critical for neurochemical function. So these are things like B vitamins, zinc, magnesium, vitamin C, and these plant flavonoids that are antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. So the diet that's higher in plant foods that has vegetables, so easy trick is to make sure half of your plate is vegetables, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you'll make sure that you get adequate servings in. You can include some fruits, things like legumes have lots of fiber in them. Whole grains can be okay for some patients. For others, you might have to watch that, especially if you are you know, a patient that's struggling with blood sugar issues, or maybe you have gluten sensitivities, you might have to watch some of that. And then, of course, the lean proteins, especially fish, are all associated with a reduced risk for depression. Whereas if you're including lots of processed food or sugary food, those are correlated with an increased risk of depression. So there have been multiple studies and meta-analysis on this that basically says, if you can adhere to a more healthful dietary pattern with more of these whole foods in it, you have a reduced likelihood of depression. Specifically, that's looking at things like that Mediterranean diet pattern, which kind of goes around what I just described being associated with 30% reduced risk. There was one specific trial that was more recent called the SMILES trial. And this was actually done in Australia, where they were using a specific dietary pattern as a randomized control trial for moderate to severe depression. So we're not talking about like just preventing some basic, you know, low level mood disorders. We are talking about people with moderate to severe depression. And they did this diet over 12 weeks and were able to demonstrate significantly greater improvement in those symptoms from baseline to 12 weeks. So 12 weeks, right? Like most people's antidepressants maybe not even are taking full effect in that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes to show how quickly a dietary intervention can actually make a significant difference. And so this particular diet focused on 12 key food groups. So again, those whole grains, vegetables, fruits, legumes. They actually included some unsweetened dairy in this, as well as nuts. Fish was at least twice a week. One unique thing about this study is that they did include lean red meats 3 to 4 times a week. And I said that this study was done in Australia. And so generally speaking in Australia, the red meat and the beef is grass-fed and finished. So that's another key component with this. The quality of the diet really does matter as well. And then it included things like chicken, eggs, which can be really great for choline and other brain nutrients, olive oil, of course, and then limiting all of those refined sweets and sugary foods. In this study, they did allow some alcohol, but generally speaking, especially with more of the newer research, there was a study that came out and said, even one drink has a negative impact on your brain health. So I know everyone likes to tout their red wine as a health food, mm-hmm. but really and truly avoid alcohol at all costs if you are going through depression or anxiety. And especially, of course, if you're on medications. I think every pharmacist will counsel you if you're taking antidepressants. There is a warning label on your drug that says you should avoid alcohol while you're taking those medications. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the note on that. But
yeah, you can use pomegranate juice if you don't have too high of blood sugars to get the antioxidants.
Yeah. Yeah. See, there's lots of other sources. You can take resveratrol as a supplement. You don't have to drink the wine, but this was a particularly powerful study that they were able to do that showed these dietary changes sure. can make a really big difference.
Yeah. And along those lines, other interventional type things that we know about are microbiome related, and certainly the diet is affecting the microbiome, but also specifically giving probiotic strains. So there was a systematic review looking at 21 studies across 1500 subjects, and they used probiotics, and 6 of them chose non-probiotic ways to look at diets, but essentially the goal of, you know, regulating the intestinal microbiome. And over half of those studies showed a positive effect on anxiety symptoms by regulating the intestinal microbiome. So that's definitely something that is a core of where we start in functional medicine with so many different conditions, but certainly with patients with anxiety. So I think we covered a lot of the nutrients to talk about as far as the omega-3s, the magnesium, the B vitamins, C, zinc, et cetera, that are important.
Okay, let's add on just a little bit to exercise. I think everyone knows exercise is good for us, right? In some way it's good, but exercise in response to mood disorders, super important. And I just saw an article come out in JAMA Psychiatry, and it was talking about people who did the recommended amount of physical activity, which the World Health Organization advises at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity, such as like brisk walking, and that's per week. So people who did that amount had a 25% lower risk of depression. But what's really cool is even at just half of that, So half of 2.5 hours of brisk walking per week, 18% still had a lower risk of depression. My takeaway from that is be active, you know, like do something. We're designed, our bodies are designed to move. And it's just so critical to find something that fits in with your lifestyle that you enjoy. Let's do something that we enjoy. If you hate running, don't go run. Like, and that was me. You know, I was trying to be a marathon runner. I'm like, wait a minute, I hate running. I don't feel good after I run, but I feel so good after I do yoga or after I go on a walk with my dog or go hike in the hill country in Texas. Like, find something that you enjoy and do it. Like, we have to move our bodies.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, one other really cool thing. I know that there's not, you know, yoga is not for everyone. I try to get my mom and my sister to do yoga with me all the time. They're like, it's just not for me. And so I've kind of come to terms with that, but yoga has there's good studies on yoga for depression and anxiety, and it can, you know, significantly reduce depression symptoms. So just so many different things. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah. And we did a podcast on movement too, with two of our yoga instructors. So you'll have to check back for that one. If you haven't listened to it already.
And even, you know, we do need some of that kind of high intensity or moderate intensity exercise, but even just gardening and being outside in the garden and cleaning your house, like add all of that up, but move your body.
Yes. Move it in nature too. So we know that green space and people being outside doing their physical activity also has an impact on mental health. So we won't go too deep into that, but definitely spend time outdoors as much as you can. And sleep. So I was mentioning this with my patients, that I'm seeing a lot of patients with a circadian rhythm disruption, but it definitely is bi-directional. So sleep causes insomnia, but sleep disorders like insomnia can increase your risk of depression just as much as the depression can cause the insomnia. So you definitely have to work at all these different layers. We always describe it as peeling back the onion and sort of figuring out what we do now and moving on and what we're uncovering about someone's health. But sleep is critical. I tell a lot of my diabetes patients, I cannot get you well if you're only sleeping 4 hours a night. I can get you to a certain point, but we have to get you sleeping 7 hours a night before we can get your body to regenerate and heal and do what it does. So sleep is so important. So some of those things we've talked about already, like the blue light blocker and glasses, you can, you know, be off electronics totally in the evening. Diet impacts sleep, caffeine. Some people are slow. If you're a slow metabolizer like me, your caffeine doesn't go away right away. So I cannot drink caffeine past noon or I'm going to be awake and that's going to impact my sleep or my sleep scores on my Oura Ring and things like that. So alcohol also impacts your sleep. We already talked about some of the negative impacts of that as well. So don't drink alcohol before bed. Even sometimes people that drink it in mid-afternoon still have an impact on their sleep. So it definitely can be something that is, if someone's using wine every evening to calm down and to, it's impacting your sleep, which in reverse is worsening other things that you've got going on. So we have to use those tools that we have and things we know to try to make lifestyle changes that are going to be important for improving your mental health. So last thing we want to cover, we're running a little bit out of time, but our last thing we want to cover is just some of these supplements that can be helpful for patients. And we're not going to necessarily go in depth into all of them because you are a unique individual that is listening to this and everybody has different needs and we don't recommend all of these things for everybody. And that's why it's really important to have some kind of provider that you work with, whether it's someone from our team at Farm to Table, or if you're working with another functional or integrative provider, having someone that knows you and knows more about you recommending specific products to you is always the best to have that patient provider relationship. We mentioned magnesium already, and there have been studies that 248 milligrams of elemental magnesium per day for 6 weeks improved patients' PHQ-9 scores, which is a score that measures depression symptoms, and also had improvements in patients' generalized anxiety scores. So we talked about magnesium. A lot of people, when they take magnesium, they can feel a pretty quick calming effect. There's actually a product called Calm, which we have no relationship to, but it is a magnesium citrate powder that you could just stir up in your, you know, drink or water, and that can be taken in the evening. Also provides some stool softening. So if you don't need the stool softening effect, we recommend other types of magnesium, but that can be a great place to start, an easy place to find even at most grocery stores. And then omega-3 fatty acids are super critical. We've talked about this a lot, but 1 to 2 grams a day. Some of the studies in depression go up to 4 grams a day. So it really is going to depend on your specific situation. Again, what do your numbers look like? Are you doing a nutrient depletion test? What is your number look like on that test, and how much do we really need to push this for certain people? So there have been studies to help people that are resistant to antidepressant medications, maybe because they're deficient in omega-3s, or maybe because they're deficient in folate and need those additional sources. So we talked about probiotics. We're not going to get into specifics. That could probably be a whole nother podcast on what strains and what types of probiotics and interventions are important for these types of conditions. But curcumin is another one. I don't know if you guys want to say anything specific about curcumin, but the one thing I think of is curcumin is just so good as an anti-inflammatory. And when Lauren was talking about inflammation being one of the root causes of depression, it really just brings that peace, helps calm down the inflammation. Any other comments or thoughts about curcumin? Okay. And then saffron is a medication, or not a medication, a supplement that has related to, very comparable to some synthetic antidepressants like fluoxetine, and that one is an herb. And then St. John's wort as well. So this can be used for depression symptoms. One of the reasons why we as pharmacists do not recommend St. John's wort very often is because it has a whole host of drug interactions. And so it interacts with a lot of medications. So if you are considering using it, you absolutely need to talk to your pharmacist, wherever they are, your community pharmacist that you can talk to, but give them your list of things that you're taking and have them check, because there are definitely drug interactions with St. John's wort that you need to be aware of. There are studies to show that it is effective as treatment for, not necessarily approved for treatment, but it has studies to show that it is as effective as standard antidepressant medications for mild to moderate depression. So definitely something to consider. L-theanine is also something to consider. So this comes from green tea, actually has L-theanine in it, or other types of tea. So that may be why if you are drinking tea, you may feel calmer than if you're drinking a cup of coffee, and because it helps to sort of counteract some of the caffeine balance. It can make you pretty calm and sleepy. I took some the other day. I was like, oh, I'm going to try this with my coffee, see if it helps a little bit. And I was like about to like fall asleep in my meeting. So don't try it during the day until you've tried it out at night to see how you react. But you can go to pretty significant levels of L-theanine in a safe manner. And then, so 5-HTP, which is L5-hydroxytryptophan, is a building block of serotonin. So some people will use that. Caution, you wouldn't want to use this in combination with serotonin SSRIs, the medications. So we want to watch out for that. And then other things like B vitamins and lemon balm. I do want to mention the lavender. So this Selexan, it's Silexan, is the trademark name. And we use a product under a different name called Lavella WS, but it uses the trademark Selexan lavender oil. But it is a specific lavender oil that has been studied. And actually they use it in Germany pretty first line, and other countries first line, for some anxiety disorders. But it has been compared against SSRI medication, against even a benzodiazepine medication, and had similar effects for reducing anxiety symptoms as those medications. And I have used it a lot in practice over the last couple years, and it doesn't work for everybody, but it is absolutely a game changer for some people. So this is the whole process of, sometimes supplements can be trial and error because, again, you are an individual, you have a specific genetic code, specific life circumstances, and this whole functional medicine process is individualized to you. So sometimes we try these things, some work, some don't, but sometimes we can get great benefits. So, you know, it's a process, and I think we talk about that a lot in functional medicine, that we're not going to change this rapidly overnight. We're going to have to work slowly, peel back the layers of the onion, and continue to help someone heal. And so these are just tools in the toolkit that you can talk to your provider about using. So Lauren, I'm going to have you finish up with our last part about some of these psychedelic medicines.
Yeah. So if you have been following any of the studies or the news in the mental health world, you've probably heard someone either in the medical literature or maybe a friend talking about using psychedelic medicines, things like psilocybin mushrooms have actually been starting to be studied again, showing that they actually can work really well, potentially in depression. But the key is that these therapies are combined with talk therapy. So you might be microdosing under the supervision of a physician, but during that microdosing trip, you are also going through psychotherapy. So that's really important to remember with these. And then the other newer treatment that they're starting to study as well is ketamine. So this is what we consider to be a rapid acting antidepressant, in that you don't have to take it for necessarily weeks or months. Most people feel immediate benefits from one session, but they'll usually do multiple. And so this again is something that is done under the supervision of a doctor, either through IV or through nasal. And they're also doing psychotherapy with this. So it's not quite as simple as just being able to take a drug and all of a sudden your depression is cured. There's still a lot of work that has to be done with these, but the premise behind both of them, again, goes back to that neuroplasticity and being able to kind of rewire some of those connections, so to speak, in a different way. And especially with things like the mushrooms, I mean, this is very ancient medicine, right? It's been around for a very long time, and now it's kind of having this resurgence again. So the jury is still out in terms of if this will become more mainstream, but certainly there's tons of research around it. So we thought it would be worth mentioning in case it is something that might help someone who can try it.
Yeah. And we didn't talk about adaptogens necessarily, but those are another thing I think about have been around a really long time. So ashwagandha and things that can be helpful for patients that have a lot of stress, and the stress is contributing to anxiety. So we talked about a lot today, and I feel like maybe we didn't get to dive in as much into these therapy options or some of the supplement type things that people are most interested in. So maybe we'll have to go back and talk about those another time too, more specifically. But hopefully this was a really well-rounded way to look at depression and anxiety and mental health. As you know, it's not just, some of the pharmacists we in this space will be like, you don't have a deficiency of Prozac, which is true, right? We don't have a deficiency of Prozac, or we don't have a deficiency of what other medication. Not that those things aren't going to be helpful. They absolutely can be helpful, but there's a lot of other things that are going to be helpful too, that are actually addressing some of the root imbalances. And that's really what we want to help our patients with, is moving through those root imbalances. And maybe someday they won't need that medication. Maybe they do still need it for a while, maybe more long-term, but overall, when we address the inflammation and when we address the gut health and when we address all these things, we're not just helping the mental health. We're helping so many other pieces in the body. And that's really what functional medicine is about thriving and helping people to thrive. So again, if you are listening to this and you have been thinking about suicide or worried about a loved one, we just want to share that number again. It's 1-800-278-8255. Again, this is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline that you can keep for those loved ones. And we are thankful to be able to share this information with you again today. So have a great rest of your day. And thank you, ladies, for joining me to talk about this for our Mental Health Awareness Month. Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.